Hey, Bob, how you doing?
I'm doing okay.
Good.
And how are you?
I'm doing well. It's nice to talk to you in this holiday season.
It is nice. I just drove home with the family from Connecticut in the wake of a blizzard. It was pretty exciting in places.
Well,
But got here in one piece.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're there in one piece.
Going to talk about, among other things, your book, Born to Be Good. I should say that you're Dacher Keltner. You teach psychology at the University of California, Berkeley. And you also run, what is it, the Greater Good Science Center?
Yeah, it's a interdisciplinary center called the Greater Good Science Center, where we disseminate this new science of positive emotion and compassion and altruism to educators and healthcare providers, and trying
Okay.
to get the ideas out.
Subtitle of your book is The Science of a Meaningful Life. And so you are, broadly speaking, part of the positive psychology phenomenon.
Yeah, I have been. I've been part of it really since its inception, and I think people think of positive psychology as having a few basic wings, if you will, and one of them is positive emotion, and that's really where I find my home.
Okay, and is this an East Coast, West Coast thing at all?
Yeah, it is. I mean, as the field has matured, how I think about it is that one piece of positive psychology is something that I think a lot of your viewers will be familiar with, which is the focus on thought patterns like optimism and hope and positive expectations. And I really view that as a kind of the East Coast, University of Pennsylvania piece of it. And out here in Berkeley, fitting to our geographical locale, we study, we're more interested in the positive emotions and
You are in
mindful.
touch with your feelings, Dacher. That's what Berkeley is for. You are in touch with your feelings.
All of them.
Well, that's good. So you
Yeah.
are, you're, it's good to have two wings. It's a sign that that of maturation when a movement has two whole wings. And then at some point, maybe there can be a momentous clash between the two, and there could be bitter fallout and stuff.
I'm hoping for that day.
That would be kind of strange for something called positive psychology, but you never know.
It's inevitable.
Let's see. I mean, there are a lot of dimensions of this. The last time I think I saw your name in print was in this David Brooks column, talking about this basketball study you did. I know you're a something of a basketball player yourself, a pickup basketball player. But you and your colleagues found something out about NBA teams and the ingredients of success, right?
Right. Well, one of the really interesting questions in thinking about Born to Be Good and sort of how we've evolved to be a really compassionate species is how in the world you convey your pro-sociality and your good intentions to other people. And one of the things that we've been focusing on in my lab is touch. It's one of the oldest communication systems in the human repertoire. It comes online first when babies are born. And so we've been doing a lot of different studies on how people in complex situations communicate kindness and compassion and trust to others. And one of the places we do it all the time is on the basketball court, right? You have big men and women, clashing, sort of crashing into each other. How do we create cooperation there? And so we think it's through the fist bumps and shoulder bumps and chest bumps of basketball. So in this study you refer to, we coded those tactile behaviors in NBA teams at the start of the season. And then we asked, how well are those teams doing at the end of the season? And what you find is the more the teams and players do these really friendly touches to each other, the chest bumps and fist bumps, the better they do at the end of the season.
So it is predictive.
It is. In the best sense that you can explore in this kind of study, which is we measure it at the beginning of the season, we control for, how much money the team's making, how well they're doing in that game. And the more they do this really, fist bumps and shoulder bumps, this cooperative touch, the better they do.
And you're something of an advocate of touch, more broadly, aren't you? I mean, I've heard you talk about this. I mean, you think we could stand to touch each other more, or am I misinterpreting you?
Oh my God. The Victorian culture did a lot of damage to the psyche of the Western individual. And one of the things that they absolutely eliminated in social contact, in social interaction, is touch. And I'll give you one empirical example. When you record the conversations of friends in different parts of the world, as one researcher did, what mm-hmm. he found is in England, they touch each other zero times. In the United States, they touch each other twice. And when you go to Latin American countries or of that ilk, they touch each other 180 times. So it's remarkable how we've taken touch out of parenting practices, and I know you've written about that, how we take touch out of medical settings. There are really interesting debates right now about, you know, the health benefits of touch in spite of concerns about infections and the like. And we've taken touch out of therapeutic settings, and I have advocated, let's bring it back in really sound ways.
I think I'm from a kind of a low-touch family. Certainly my father was not a toucher. I guess my mother was quite an empathetic and compassionate person, but I think even she was a little restrained. So you think I might be a totally different person if I had come from a high-touch family? Do you look at, like, low-touch and high-touch families and stuff?
There are, and this is in a way where this research began, which is when you study the evolution of primate caregiving behavior and attachment behavior, uh-huh. you find so much of attachment is about touch, right? It's just holding a very vulnerable offspring close to you for a lot of good reasons. And what we are learning in this new literature on the science of touch is that families that have a lot of touch, right, their kids feel more secure, they explore more, they feel more confident in the world. So it's you've made it in spite of your early deficits, Bob.
Well, the jury's out, I think, on that. but anyway, it was not a big part of my life.
No. How about now?
What's that?
How about now? Has basketball, your love of basketball, taught you this language?
I did do the fist bumps or whatever they were doing back when I played basketball. I got to say, being a part of a successful team is one of the most gratifying experiences in the world. And it isn't winning per se. It can be the case that being on the winning team is no fun if it's not really a team effort. But when you have that feeling that you're firing on all cylinders and everyone, you're making the good passes and everyone's filling in for everybody else, it is one of the greatest feelings in the world, really.
Yeah, it is.
And is that, I mean, do we not have enough of that these days, too, in some sense?
I think, Emile Durkheim, the great sociologist, wrote about, and it's really interesting to think about culture and feeling, which is there is a whole repertoire of individual or self-based feelings, right? Pride and hope and certain mm-hmm. kinds of fear. And he wrote about these emotions that they're really part of collective life. Right, like awe, which is something that I've been studying, or ecstasy, or love of humanity, if you will, mm-hmm. which people have been writing about for 3,000 years. And I think it's fair to say that we have a more impoverished vocabulary and everyday experience of these collective joys that are really part of culture and evolution.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you mentioned awe. I know you're a big awe fan.
Yeah.
How do you define awe? It seems to be a pretty amorphous thing that in different contexts is described in different ways. What's your thumbnail definition?
My thumbnail definition of awe, and it's tricky to define because you feel awe for a political figure at a political rally or a sports team or you're around a celebrity or a redwood tree or even a transcendent piece of music, and so. How I define awe is it really is the feeling of being in the presence of something that is greater than the self, that really transcends your current understanding of the world.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any, there's no settled view, is there or is there, on the evolutionary origins of awe, why we can feel awe, what value it would have been to our ancestors or their genes or something to feel awe?
Well, it's this striking question for people who like to approach things from an evolutionary perspective, which is why in the world, right, would we have evolved an emotion, mm-hmm. which in its highest forms makes you give things away and sacrifice and really you know, jeopardize self-interest. And there are a couple of perspectives on it. One is a perspective that I've been advocating, although there aren't a lot of good data for this, which is awe is about settling the individual into a hierarchy that organizes a social collective, right? So when I feel awe for a sports figure, a cultural idea, or a political figure, or somebody in my own group, my father or my mother, it really is putting the individual into a social collective and quieting the press of self-interest. Other people have written that it really is about attaching to groups or social collectives, through religion. So there are different evolutionary perspectives on it, and we'll see what the data say.
Yeah, you know, Paul Bloom, the psychologist at Yale, was on Blogging Heads, and he was talking about kind of the dark side of awe, or at least saying that he didn't think it was an unalloyed blessing. And I think he probably had in mind something like the natural history you just described. I mean, another way of putting what you just said is awe can be can pave the way for submission, abject submission,
right,
when that seems to be in your interest, right? And the thing you submit yourself to might or might not be a good thing. It's just that it would be a very powerful thing, right?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, this is one of the, and I think Darwin would agree with this, you know, who really founded our field, which is that emotions like awe or embarrassment or anger or love give you this broad propensity to do things, right? Mm-hmm. And then what happens is that, you know, we are these very specific cultural groups, and we develop unique cultures depending on our geographical setting or our social organization or our moment in history. And culture feeds in the moral content of an emotion. So awe can lead us to our greatest achievements and the most interesting human developments, right? Darwin's experience of awe in the Amazon at natural patterns is one example. Or awe can lead us to great atrocity. You know, there was a lot of awe felt, obviously, in the vis-a-vis Hitler, but also, for example, in the recent Rwandan genocide, where the people who killed and felt a lot of awe about the actions that they were engaging in. So it's the challenge of culture to make it work well.
Okay. Well, I will work on that.
That's your job.
Okay. I may turn to you for guidance from time to time. So talk a little about oxytocin, which is, by now, I guess, needs no introduction. I mean, it kind of burst on the scene of popular science, I don't know, 15 years or so ago when we started untangling the role it plays in maternal bonding during nursing. But lately, there's been a lot of data from behavioral economics about how oxytocin gives rise to trust and so on. You're an oxytocin fan?
Yeah, and a scientist who tries to study this mysterious neuropeptide. So oxytocin is a little chemical, a sequence of 9 amino acids. It's produced near the hypothalamus in your brainstem, and it's a very interesting chemical because it shoots up into your brain and has circuits there, and then it moves down into your what we call the peripheral nervous system, which lies below your brainstem and activates heart rate and breathing and muscular response and the like. And it's a fascinating chemical when you situate it in broader ideas about human nature, right? If you think about the selfish gene hypothesis from 1978 of Richard Dawkins, it says, it just leads you to believe, and his book is full of this language, which is, down in the genes, it's all about self-interest, right? That is the organization, the principle of our genetic design. Well, lo and behold, starting, as you said, in 1992, researchers like Sue Carter, and then we've been part of this tradition, have been looking at this really neat chemical, oxytocin, which is involved in milk letdown, breastfeeding, uterine contractions in women. And then more recently, it's involved in, I think science is making the case that this is a chemical genetically designed that helps us trust and helps us give to others and act altruistically, right? So what we're finding is, wow, a little spray of oxytocin in your nose makes you give away money in economic games. It makes you judge emotions better from facial expressions. It makes men, when they've kissed their romantic partner, feel more love and devotion to the romantic partner, although it didn't affect women in that way. It makes men, in a recent study, have more memories, believe it or not, of their mother. So there's this whole broad argument in which people are saying, this system, this chemical system in our body, makes us good to others. It makes us trust.
Okay, now to back up a little, though, I think Richard Dawkins would say, in his defense, that his point was that, according to the theory of natural selection, traits that evolve by virtue of being conducive to the proliferation of the genes underlying the trait. And I think he would argue that in those cases, and he certainly did not mean to exclude, far from it, I'd say, the possibility that this so-called selfishness, this kind of selfishness at the metaphorical level of the gene, could translate into altruism at the individual level. And I think he would say in all these cases, the altruism at the individual level evolved because it did serve the interests of the gene. So to go back to the most elemental example involving oxytocin, mother-infant bonding. Apparently, when I think it's the case, I think I read this, back when my wife was having a baby or something. I hope it's actually true, but you can tell me that nursing in a mother releases oxytocin and presumably helps her fall more deeply in love with the baby. It cements the bond. And that, of course, is a case where, yes, the mother is altruistic toward the baby, but the baby is carrying the mother's genes, and that is the reason that natural selection favors generous behavior toward the offspring, right?
Right, but you know, Bob, and I know you've written about this, and this has been part of your work as well, which is that, yes, that's correct in the absolute sense, which is that, you know, all of our genetic propensities eventually downstream within our social organization benefit the genes that build the systems that enable those propensities. But I think a lot of the field out of that selfish gene hypothesis went in a slightly different direction, of an inferential direction, which is they said, oh, if genes are selfish, then human nature and our genetic design is really about maximizing short-sighted self-interest, right? Even George Williams, who wrote some of the early arguments for what an adaptation is, said evolution is about really short-sighted, amoral behavior, really benefiting the self at the expense of others. And so,
amoral, I think, in the sense that it's not necessarily good or bad. The fact that natural selection selects it, preserves it, is not a comment on its goodness or badness. It could lead to good things. It could lead to bad things.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt about that. And I think he actually even made a stronger statement, George Williams, that it's about maximizing immoral behavior. And I think that's where a lot of the science went after, in the wake of that very influential argument, which is, the human organism is really designed for self-interest, for protecting the self, psychologically defined, right, within my sort of bag of skin. And this oxytocin literature, the new literature on the neuroscience of giving in the brain, the literature that I'm part of on this fascinating bundle of nerves, the vagus nerve, says, actually, there are really sound evolutionary reasons to make the case that we are a profoundly cooperative species that very often gives at the expense of the self.
Begin? I think it's true. In natural, back during natural selection, if a trait evolved that systematically led you to give at the expense of the self, again, it would be because ultimately it served the genes. But I think, especially in a modern environment, that doesn't have to always be the case by any means. And in fact, a lot of people take, I guess I would say the good news is that the positive emotions evolved for whatever reason. Even if in some cases they were designed to be used in what I might call a kind of a cynical fashion, They don't. First of all, they're not always designed to be used that way. There is genuine sacrifice of self in the interest of others, especially Ken, which is kind of natural in the strictest sense. But beyond that, we can, upon reflection, use our emotions as we see fit. And a lot of people, you know, you have your Gandhis or whoever, your deeply sacrificial people, who use them in a way that, in some sense, natural selection didn't design them to be used, maybe, but it's all the more extraordinary. Does that make any sense?
I mean, that's how we're thinking about the emotions right now, and it makes extraordinary sense. But I'd push the argument even further, which is, you know, how we're thinking about this is that the good news is, you know, with this new science of oxytocin as one example, is that, as Darwin said in The Descent of Man in 1871, sympathy and an other orientation is our strongest instinct, stronger within the rigors of evolutionary argument than the preservation of self. And I think there are a lot of good reasons why sympathy is our strongest instinct. And the really good news is we have this capacity. It engages frontal regions in the brain, oxytocin networks, the vagus nerve. So it's right there physiologically. And then you add to that a lot of new data that are mounting that say acts of altruism are activating reward centers in the brain. Sacrifice later in life in your 60s and 70s gives you a pretty strong boost to your longevity. It activates the immune system and the like. So there are a lot of really interesting new kinds of good news that say, consistent with Darwin, that we're a pretty pro-social species and we don't have to work too hard to bring that out.
Yeah, I guess I worry a little about the kind of complacency that emphasis can give rise to.
Yeah, that's a good point.
In other words, you know, it's true that people everywhere do deploy their sympathies and their empathy and so on. And if they want, they can pat themselves on the back about how great they're being. But if you go to a place like the Middle East, what you'll see is a lot of Israelis are being sympathetic to other Israelis and really working to see their perspective, and a lot of Palestinians are doing the same with respect to other Palestinians. And they can sit around and tell themselves they've done all they can, they're wonderful people. But no, the fact is they both need to do something else, which is to do the hard thing, to use your sympathies the way, in a sense, they're not designed to be deployed,
which
is to extend them beyond your kin and tribe and do the really hard work necessary to see things from the point of view of someone whom it's easy to define as your enemy. And when I look around at the great problems of the world, I see often it's people doing what comes naturally, including indulging their positive emotions in a natural way. And in a sense, the problem is not deploying them in an unnatural way.
Right. Yeah, that's actually that's a very subtle and important point, and I agree with you. You know, and in a way, it's the great challenge of culture and cultivation, which is, you know, people like Peter Singer, your colleague out at Princeton, have been arguing that the really challenging dimension to human moral development is what he calls to extend the circle of care. And
right.
It's very natural to feel sympathy for your child, which, after all, has half your genes, and your brother or sister, and maybe your neighbor, right? Who you most typically in U.S. is somebody who's very similar to you.
Mm-hmm.
The real challenge of moral development is to extend it to your adversaries and to people far away. And I'm optimistic about that. I think there are a lot of new reasons and mechanisms by which we'll be doing that to a greater extent. So I absolutely agree. And, you know, to put a really strong point on that, we've been doing a lot of work on social class right now, and you may have heard about some of this work. And what we're finding is that, boy, as people gain education and economic wealth and are doing better, regrettably, their tendencies towards compassion become much more constrained. They're less generous to strangers, to people who are different, and even less generous on the whole. So that would suggest this is one of the great challenges of our ethical development, is always to think about compassion.
Yeah. Well, and you hang out a little bit with the Dalai Lama. Is that in a too misleading a way to put it? And he's certainly a big proponent of extending your empathy broadly, right? You have spent you've gotten a little FaceTime with the Dalai Lama. Is that right?
I have. You know, the Dalai Lama is you know, he had a background in engineering, and he loves science, and he's been having these dialogues with scientists for the past 12 to 15 years, and mm-hmm. I was lucky and privileged to be on a couple of panels with him, and, you know, in one in Canada, to spend 20 minutes telling him about this crazy research on touch and oxytocin and the like, which he's mm-hmm. fascinated by. And, you know, his philosophy, and this is one of my reasons for optimism, is the rise of Eastern thought in the West. And, you know, what he says very simply is, if you want others to be happy, practice compassion. And mm-hmm. if you want to be happy, practice compassion. And mm-hmm. and I think it's back to your point, Bob, which is, it's that word practice, right, that really is the ethical emphasis of go beyond what's natural and just try to build this into your mind and to your ethical practice.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's been, you know, I have to say, my last Technicolor experience of awe was the second time I was with the Dalai Lama and, you know, greeting him and just thinking about what he has achieved as a human being. And it was a full-blown experience with some materialistic constraints.
What, you mean you had an almost religious experience, or?
I did. I had a Darwinian religious experience, which is
goosebumps. What's that like?
Well, it was, you know, goosebumps and tearing up and feeling like I was in the presence of somebody profoundly good, although all of his friends will say he gets angry just like you or I do. And a sense that we can achieve remarkable good in our lives. But then the Darwinian version was just to think about it from just in the body and where that might come from evolutionarily.
Mm-hmm. Without diminishing the experience too much. You can always save the analysis for later, I guess, and enjoy the experience while it's happening.
Yeah, no doubt.
And how much of that do you think is a tribute to really these distinctive properties he has as a person? And to what extent do you think the expectation you carry into an encounter with the guy called the Dalai Lama, you know, with his reputation and all of that?
Yeah. Well, you know, what I can tell you is, you know, obviously when I first encountered the Dalai Lama at MIT at a conference, you arrive in the morning, there are hundreds of meditators with gongs, mm-hmm. You go into the auditorium, you go through security. You are up on a stage where there are, you know, a couple thousand rapt listeners. I mean, it is sociologically, he has a lot of advantages, more so than you or I when we give our talks at book signings or the like.
Yeah, I mean, you said he has accomplished a lot. It's true. On the other hand, if when I was 5 years old, somebody came up and anointed me the Dalai Lama, I think I would have sold more books, you know, by now. That is an advantage, let's face it.
I'm working on it, Bob. I've put your name in, so you may get a call.
You think it's not too late?
I don't think so.
You know, it is amazing to me that they choose this guy, right? I don't know at what age they designate the person the Dalai Lama, but it's interesting to me that, I mean, of course, if you're a believer in their religious tradition, I guess you believe that they were in some sense divinely or supernaturally guided to the one right person. But me, looking at it from the outside, I'm just thinking, you know, they're doing the best they can, and it's just a large-scale talent search. It's kind of amazing to me that they don't just wind up with a really bad pick, you know, a guy who just embarrasses them as an adult. Quite the contrary, seems to be a guy who is quite adept at compassion and has this kind of quiet charisma.
Well, you know, that's the thing, Bob. I mean, when you dive into what it means to be trained in, you know, the Tibetan strain of Buddhism, it really mm-hmm. is a lesson about, you know, what Peter Singer was talking about with respect to cultivating and expanding your circle of care, which is they meditate starting at 4 a.m. for 3 hours. Mm-hmm. They debate rigorously for hours each day as they're trained in their, you know, their seminaries. Mm-hmm. Their understanding of the emotions and the mental states that are related to joy and compassion and contentment and peace is way beyond what the finest Western science can say about those emotions. They've been thinking about this for 2,500 years and doing a different kind of empirical method, which is testing and exploring their experiences in meditation. Mm-hmm. So when I met the Dalai Lama, I was blown away by the knowledge base. And then, you know, as Paul Ekman said, he is the greatest Olympic athlete of compassion and social connection that he's ever met. And I would agree. I mean, when you meet him and you make eye contact with him and he holds your hands, he's doing that as well as anybody I've ever been around. And it's a powerful experience.
And it's partly because he's truly absorbed in it. He is focused.
Yeah, I think so. I honestly think so.
He's mindful, as they say, in Buddhism.
Yes.
They say the same thing about Bill Clinton.
And they say the same thing about you.
I don't think they do. I don't think anyone's ever asked them. So the vagus nerve, something I had never, I think, until I read your stuff, I don't think I had even maybe heard of the vagus nerve, but you are possibly the world's leading proponent of the vagus nerve, and every interest group should have a proponent, I think. So explain this.
Yeah, you know, and I may lose all my scientific reputation on this, but, you know, this is what's thrilling from a scientific perspective, right? So, you know, as I was doing the research for Born to Be Good, and I dove back into the evolutionary scholarship, you know, and I read Darwin, and I read some of your work, and I read a lot of the recent evolutionary thinking about altruism, one of the implications of this neo-Darwinian perspective that we are a sympathetic species is that sympathy and trust and compassion should really be built into our nervous systems, right? Mm-hmm. There should be parts of the brain and neurotransmitters and bundles of nerves through the body that help us care and take care and feel compassion. And it turns out the vagus nerve may be our best candidate. And so anatomically, the vagus nerve is this bundle of nerves. It starts at the top of your spinal cord. It's unique to mammals. It activates muscles that help you vocalize, nod your head, and orient to other people. It drops down into your chest and slows your heart rate so that you can orient and move forward and help others. It regulates digestive response. And it also, recent studies show, is interconnected with immune system response. So it really helps us engage a robust immune response. And there's this amazing recent science I've been part of that shows that vagal activation, activation of the vagus nerve, may be involved in compassion, generosity, and cooperation. So to me, that's astonishing that not only can you make the argument that we can be sympathetic, but we have these old mammalian bundles of nerves that were designed to do that work.
Mm-hmm. And it is loaded with oxytocin receptors, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, there are new studies of rats that are suggesting that, you know, the vagus nerve, as it wanders through the periphery of your body, is also up in the central nervous system, interconnected with oxytocin networks. So it's this, you know, it's this amazing mind-body site, which is, it's involved in giving, in nurturing behavior and compassion, and through oxytocin, and then it's also involved in physical health and well-being. So it's a great place to study the issues that I'm interested in.
And you think that your goodness as a person may bear some correlation to the robustness of your vagus nerve? Kind of.
I think this is going to be the new way that we select judges and do personnel searches.
just give them the vagus test.
Exactly.
Big time saver.
So here's what we do, Bob. We bring someone into the lab, right? Mm-hmm. And you attach electrodes and you monitor somebody's breathing. And we can infer from patterns of respiration and how that influences your cardiovascular response, that correlation of those two cycles is regulated by the vagus nerve. And we measure that. And then that tells us, in a resting state, how strong is Bob Wright's vagus nerve, right? Or how strong is anybody's vagus nerve, or what we call vagal tone? And when we capture that, the stronger your vagal tone, the more likely you are to cooperate, the more compassionate you are, you're more generous in economic gains. Kids who have strong vagal tone are sort of nominated by their teachers as the really cooperative, considerate kids in the classroom. It really seems to be this physiological system that helps us give to others.
And we don't know yet to what extent the development of a robust vagal capacity or whatever is a matter of environment, and to what extent, you know, some people are just born lucky.
Yeah, you know, that's the age-old question. The minute you get to these you know, physiological systems that are part of your temperament, are you cooperative or more Machiavellian in mm-hmm. this particular case? A big question is, well, you know, how much of this is genetically determined? And most of the science says about half, right?
Mm-hmm.
How can we cultivate it? And this is where, you know, and part of the theme of our conversation is, you know, wow, how do we bring online more of these ethical tendencies or compassionate tendencies? And we know things like, you know, deep breathing, exercise, forms of contemplation, touch, tactile exchanges all activate the vagus nerve in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe as we practice this stuff, we'll move toward that Dalai Lama profile.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I will...
You'll wait and hear.
I'll wait until it's really easy and cheap to get your vagus nerve tested. There's no mail-in version of the vagal test, right? I can't just, like, put some saliva on a card and mail it to you and you tell me how my vagal nerve is?
Not yet.
No. Not yet. It's Vegas. V-A-G-U-S, right?
V-A-G-U-S. That's right.
V-A-G-U-S. Now, in your book, in Born to Be Good, I noticed there was one emphasis that I hadn't especially expected in a book about kind of positive, upbeat emotions, and that was a lot of emphasis, as I recall, on embarrassment.
Yeah.
Why does embarrassment fit into this book?
Well, you know, and it's interesting because, and you always have to think about the cultural lens, which is that if you look at the quality of the feeling that accompanies embarrassment around the world, in many other parts of the world, embarrassment actually feels kind of positive. And in the West,
really?
We really don't like the experience because quite
the contrary. Where do they enjoy it?
They enjoy
these people
in East Asian cultures, in a lot of collectivist cultures, Bedouin societies.
You know, it's funny you should mention that because before I went to China this last summer for the first, well, as you know, you were there, and we only spoke briefly, but we both spoke at this the first ever international conference on positive psychology in China, I guess.
Yeah.
But before I went, somebody who had been said, you know, in Chinese culture, they're very big on teasing each other. And I'll tell you, while I was there, you know, after the conference, they were such generous hosts there. My family and I went to the city of Xi'an, which I'm no doubt pronouncing wrong. But we got a certain amount of kind of off time just with Chinese people, with our hosts, observing them. And I've got to say, they teased in a way, including teasing some of the Americans for things like being a little overweight or something.
I got that one that
we would not do here, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you know, here's the thing, which is, you know, and this flows right out of an evolutionary analysis, as you might anticipate, which is, we evolved in these complex social units. So small groups, 75 to 100, whatever it
mm-hmm.
is. We had a bunch of rules that sort of organized our social exchanges. And humans are just bound to engage in, you know, conflictual behavior, and we break our rules. And so what we needed was a mechanism that really apologized for our transgressions and brought about reconciliation, right,
mm-hmm.
or forgiveness in other
mm-hmm.
terminology. And so a lot of data, for example, in the primate world and then studies that we've been conducting suggest that embarrassment and sort of this form of modesty and shrinkage and blushing, even as Charles Darwin wrote,
mm-hmm.
is a way in which we signal to other people. We say, hey, I'm sorry, I made
yeah.
a mistake, I overstepped the bounds here.
You're right.
And I apologize. And,
right.
and a lot of data that suggest when we're embarrassed, people like us more, they trust us more, they think we're morally upstanding. It's a way we show our commitment to the moral rules that organize us.
Right. And, you know, it's true that making fun of people's transgressions, of their screw-ups,
right?
Can be, and this varies tremendously on by cultural context, but it can be taken as a form of affection and a mechanism of inclusion. You know, it's like when you're at a workplace and somebody, whatever, spills coffee, does something wrong, and instead of it being this awkward, you know, thing that people try to get past, it turns into some kind of joke, and maybe even some kind of joke about a particular consistent kind of weakness or clumsiness that a person has. I mean, that's a kind of organization that has a sort of organic, you know, foundation, a sort of organic unity that an organization with less teasing, you know, might not have.
Well, you're speaking my language, you know, and I've done a lot of work, and it came out of my work on embarrassment, which is all these studies I did on embarrassment showed if I get embarrassed around you, right, through you've teased me or whatever mm-hmm. the case may be, or the Chinese people tease me about my weight, which happened, and you're absolutely right, I show this response, and you respond with a lot of affection. And we
right.
get stronger and closer out of that,
right.
even though in the West we don't understand that. And teasing is one of the great ways in which we produce that great dynamic. In every study we've done of teasing, Bob, and I've studied the teasing of mothers and children, of romantic partners, kids in a basketball camp, sorority sisters, fraternity brothers, just about everybody, after they tease each other, they feel closer because of this
yeah.
great exchange.
Yeah. I come from a family of teasers.
Yeah.
And there's an issue with me and my wife where I kind of accuse her family of being not so receptive to teasing.
Yeah.
And I don't know. There may be ethnic differences and so on. We are from different cultural backgrounds, but it's different, you know. And I think there are probably socioeconomic differences, too. I would suspect that
yeah.
teasing at lower income levels or maybe in urban low-income urban settings or something, I got to think. Teasing is a little less restrained.
Oh, my God. I mean, you know, the legendary forms of teasing that scientists have gone after, you know, is playing the dozens in African-American communities.
Right, right.
Which really need history behind that. It's all this street corner yo mama stuff,
mm-hmm.
Which had this great poetic form, and it gave rise to hip-hop and rap, some people believe. You know, in the Latino culture, enormous amounts of teasing, no holds barred, and again, it was this arena of affection that we
yeah.
often misunderstand in our own culture.
I just flash back to Leonard Grant when I was in high school. You know, the place I was a freshman at high school where I played JV basketball was the place where Shaquille O'Neal later played his high school basketball. But anyway, it was a mainly white place. It was a military base. He was an Army brat like me.
Uh-huh.
And so we had it was a largely white culture, but there was this guy, Leonard Grant, who was such a great basketball player. And he just showed up there. It was his first year at the school. And, I mean, he transformed the culture of that team. I mean, it was when you said yo mama that
yeah.
I thought of Leonard.
Yeah.
And he just carried teasing to a whole new level that a lot of us had no contact with. But you know, by the end of the season it was all good. It was just the way
yeah.
it was just the way you did it.
Yeah.
And it was because he was a great player that we were willing to adopt his culture. But it was a very unified team.
Yeah. You know, I mean I had the same experience. I was kind of overly sensitive, and I didn't take teasing too well when I was a kid for a lot of reasons I won't go into, nor do I understand. But I remember playing on this football team, intramural football team in college, and it was all African-Americans and then me. And all they did was tease each other in this
yeah.
terrific language. And then I suddenly realized, oh, this is about friendship. This isn't about criticism.
Yeah.
And I think the science has borne that out.
So. Yeah.
Great lessons from other cultures.
Well, I guess we've about exhausted our time, so I guess we can close on a note of mutual affirmation of teasing and its value.
That's right.
But I also should encourage people again to read your book, Born to Be Good. And to look at your website, which we'll link to, Dacher.
Okay.
It's got Greater Good in the URL, but it's got something else. Maybe it's got Berkeley in the URL or something?
I think it's just greatergoodscience.org.
Greatergoodscience.org, okay.
Yeah, a lot of fun.
But it is physically at Berkeley. And I want to thank you for this. Unbeknownst to our audience, this is actually a redo. We had a conversation beset by technical difficulties. But I'm glad we did this over because now I know almost twice as much.
Well, it only gets better with age.
It only gets better with age, yes. I remember it well. Okay. Well, thanks a lot, and I hope you'll be back on Blogging Heads soon.
Thank you, Bob. I hope so. And okay. Happy holidays.
All right. You too. Happy New Year.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.